This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to The Big Picture for this week's Financial Sense News Hour. We have an interesting program lined up for you here. The first part will be an analysis between Jim Poplava and myself of what's going on this week in the markets as the euphoria continues. And the second part of The Big Picture today will feature an interview with Charles Gav of Gav Cal Research and his new book, which expresses concerns about, well, some of the very same things we're going to discuss here during The Big Picture today. Now, Jim, you must admit, you've been talking about historic low interest rates until recently. We are living in an historic week this week in the markets because the Dow did something it hasn't been able to do for the last 6 weeks. We breached the 20,000 level, which I'm sure isn't news to anybody by now since everybody's been talking about it on the channels. This week, the Dow, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and the Russell set new record levels in the stock market. So the stock market continues to be euphoric over the Trump presidency. And finally, something we've been talking about for ages, individual investors are saying we're getting back in after 8 years of sitting on the sidelines.
Well, nothing like all-time record highs in the stock market, especially when the stock market's up over 10% in such a short period of time, because there is, John, you're right, there's a lot of this euphoria over the Trump presidency, and for a number of reasons. First of all, the president's talking about stimulating the economy, bringing jobs back, which he's shown he's already done with Carrier, some of the automakers, resurrecting the Keystone Pipeline, which would create 28,000 jobs. So there's a lot of sort of anticipation that, gosh, all of this stuff has got to be good. And if you think about it, let's say that the corporate tax rate is cut from 35% down to 20. Now, Trump wants it to go down to 15%. The Republican plan is 20. So maybe they compromise, let's say it's 20%. Now, think about that, what that means for a corporation. Let's say that a company makes $100 million in profits and they have to pay 35% in taxes. That means they would pay $35 million in taxes. If the tax rates drop to 15%, or 20%, instead of paying $35 million in taxes, a company would only pay $15 million or $20 million, which could be a savings of $20 million to $15 million. And what does that mean? It means more money on the bottom line. That means higher earnings. Now, if we take a look at where the stock market has gone since this recovery in 2009, a lot of what we've seen in the stock market has been financial engineering. Companies refinancing their debt at lower interest rates, which translates into lower interest expense. One of the reasons why utilities have done so well. In addition to that, companies have been buying back their stock. In fact, one of the big players in this bull market has been central banks and corporate buybacks, which have been to the tune of almost $500 billion per year. So it is assumed if, number one, we lower tax rates and allow this $2.5 trillion of untaxed profits overseas to come home, that money is going to get used for investment. It's going to be used for mergers. It's going to be used to raise dividends. And so the stock market, John, right now is euphoric because they're thinking, gosh, all of these wonderful things, we are finally going to go from the anti-growth policies of the Obama administration to pro-growth policies of the Trump administration, which is why, contrary to some of these gloom and doom predictions that were made if Trump won, we saw just the opposite. The stock market is at all-time highs. We're setting all-time records, and we're up over 10%. But John, I think once again, as we have pointed out, since the stock market started to take off towards the end of the year, and more recently in the forecast shows that we've done, that there is a lot of euphoria here that is getting way ahead of actual reality.
Okay, well, now let's take a look at some of the claims versus maybe what's reality. President Trump's administration is saying that they're going to take economic growth, and you know it's been pretty anemic. It's a little over 2%. And they say they're going to, what, double that, move it up to 3 or 4%? Is that real in your mind?
I really don't think so. I just don't think, given the levels of debt that the federal government has, let's put it this way. President Trump is not in the same situation as George W. Bush was in 2001 when the federal funds rate was 5% and Greenspan brought it down to 1%, and Bush was only dealing with a $5 trillion total federal debt. Today, Trump is dealing with $20 trillion, a quadrupling of the debt. A doubling under Bush and a doubling under Obama. So he doesn't have the same leeway, even though there is agreement because Democrats are talking about they want to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Trump wants to spend $1 trillion. He also wants to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of almost $400 or $500 billion to rebuild the defense. So a lot of this is going to be determined by what happens in interest rates. If the bond market rebels and bond interest rates skyrocket like they did. You got to remember, when interest rates hit a low of 1.3% in June, they got up to 1.8% the day before the election. And after the election, bond interest rates went from 1.8 to 2.6, with many people feel with two or three rate hikes coming from the Fed this year, we could be at over 3%. Now, higher interest rates are going to put a damper on a lot of the ambitions of the Trump administration, because we all know as interest rates go up, it costs more to borrow, whether you're getting a home loan, a home equity loan, a car loan. And also, you have to remember, even though the president is talking with the automobile industry, we have gone through one heck of an automobile cycle these last 5 or 6 years, where a lot of the fleet in the United States has been replaced. A lot of people, I don't know what it's like where you live, John. You go to parking lots here or to stores and you see a lot of new cars in the parking lot. A lot of people have been able to get new cars because the cost of financing a new car has been almost zero.
In the two shows we did at the beginning of the year, which we do at the beginning all the time, predicting what's coming for the year, I think your theme was expect the unexpected. And maybe in expecting the unexpected, we should expect some kind of a major clash here between the Trump administration and the Yellen Fed. I think there's going to be a clash. And we're not alone in this thinking, because similar sentiments were expressed by Felix Zulauf from Zulauf Asset Management, also a member of Barron's Roundtable. Let's listen.
Well, I think the year ahead will be very volatile in terms of geopolitics. You have to understand that there is a new power coming up, which is China, and it is challenging and provoking the U.S. In trade, and Trump will go after them in some ways. That is very similar to what happened before the World War I, when Germany rose and provoked and challenged Great Britain and France to some degree. And at the same time, you had the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy that was beginning to decay. And today, the analogy would be the European institution that has a wrong institutional architecture that seems to be at risk of falling apart. We have important elections coming up in France in particular that will be key in late April and early May. And if Marie Le Pen, the nationalist socialist leader, if she wins, she will probably take France out of the EU and out of the euro. And that would be the end of the euro and the end of the current structure. So there is going to be a lot of turmoil, which will weaken global trade tremendously further over time. And at the same time, you have the new president in the US, and you have a lot of euphoria, and people are expecting a lot from him. And it seems like the wall of worry that we have seen over the last few years, which held back retail investors from the stock market, investments to a large degree, is beginning to crumble.
And that's a contrarian sign. Investors, when investors are worrying, often the market can go up, but once they get too jubilant, there's no one else to buy.
Yes, I think we have, you know, the world economy has an uptick since the middle of last year, 16, and people take confidence from there that it will get better. I think you will see bond yields rising quite fast into, let's say, fall of this year, and at some point from the middle of this year on or so, I think that will be a big problem for the stock market.
So there you go, Jim. Felix Zuloff, not just you expressing that sentiment, but Felix Zuloff echoing that well, a respected member of the Barron's Roundtable. So people are already looking beyond the euphoria.
And you got to remember, too, bear markets always end in euphoria because it's, you know, when everybody, as Felix just mentioned in that clip there, he said, when everybody is climbing the wall of worry, when we're worried about China, we're worried about economic growth or the Fed doing this or this crisis, when everybody is in the worry mode, that's when, you know, stock markets go up. When it flips, and the little guy, the individual investor, starts rushing in the stock market as they're doing now. And we've been seeing this with mutual fund inflows into equity funds are coming in at a fast pace now. Everybody's excited because what are they talking about on TV, on the financial stations? Dow 20,000. Well, we just broke through 20,000 this week and we're at what? Almost Dow 20,100. But here's the point that Zuloff and some of the members of the roundtable have mentioned. Every recession since World War II has been preceded by a Fed tightening cycle, something I wrote about in my recent article called The Inheritance. And John, there was only one exception to that, at least in my career, which spans over three decades. And that was 1994, when Greenspan raised the Fed funds rate from 3% to 6%. Of course, we had an international incident. We had the peso crisis. But the Fed was able to engineer sort of a soft landing because we never had a recession. The recession would not begin until 2001. So here we are, Trump is entering office, and we got the Fed talking about doing a number of things, not just tightening interest rates, but what is even more alarming, which we'll get to here shortly, is the Fed is talking about shrinking its balance sheet, which is currently about $4.5 trillion. Remember, prior to the crisis, the Fed only had $800 billion. Now it has $4.5 trillion.
You know, last week we talked about your article looking forward on where things actually are, but that's not the only article out there. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal entitled Day One for Trump's Economy in Charts. So I guess anticipating exactly what Donald Trump is going to be able to achieve.
Well, it was amazing because they started out the article that he assumes office with a historically weak economic expansion. And I'm sure listeners have heard that numerous times in the media, that it's probably the slowest economic expansion in history since World War II. But it talked about, okay, what does it look like? And they just did a number of charts. And they said, for example, the prime age workforce, which is individuals from age 25 to 55, is the largest. In other words, work age workforce dropouts is the largest it's been since the 90s and the 2000s. A second thing they talked about is Trump will face either two things in his presidency. If he avoids a recession, it'll end up being the longest historical economic expansion in history because it's already 8 years. Let's assume he can avoid a recession another 4 years. That would be a 12-year economic expansion, which would certainly be one for the record books. Or he's more likely to face a recession. So there's two things the journal was talking about. He's either going to get a recession or we're going to set another record for the history books. Then it talked about a number of positive things. Number one, oil production is back, rising again. That's good for maintaining lower oil prices, or at least keeping oil prices from spiking to $70 or $80 a barrel. The trade deficit has been stabilized. However, then they talked about it, a number of negatives, which is blue-collar workers, which is one reason why Trump won the election, he took some of those Rust Belt states, is blue-collar jobs in construction and manufacturing are still much lower than where they were in the peak of the economic cycle between 2005 and, let's say, 2008. The other thing is U.S. exports are getting hurt by a rising dollar. And it was no surprise last week, one of the stories was President Trump tweeting out that he thought the dollar was too high, and then there was a dollar sell-off, and gold prices spiked as a result. The other thing the Wall Street Journal talked about is, since the crisis, home ownership is at its lowest level it's been in a decade. So rising interest rates obviously are not going to be good news. Home ownership has gone from 68% in 2008 to little over 62% in 2016. So home ownership is down, and I can't help but believe if the Fed continues to raise interest rates and mortgage rates rise, it's going to make it more difficult for first-time home buyers to qualify. So that could be hurt. So the Journal talked about a number of things that the president faces. And I'm glad to see it's not just us talking about it. We mentioned last week, PBS did a special report. You can get that at PBS. And it's basically the same thing. What Trump faces by the numbers. The Wall Street Journal did another one this week. What Trump faces by the charts, using charts to illustrate the number of things that the new administration faces, despite its aggressive agenda to revitalize the economy.
Well, as we discussed last week, too, on the program, and this is that confrontation we were mentioning between Trump and Yellen brewing on the horizon, the Fed is talking about aggressive interest rate hikes, saying now that we don't need any kind of stimulus or to keep things low. And, of course, this always puts a slowdown in the economy.
You know, it's interesting because there was an article in the Journal that recently came out that talked about three things that are changing at the Fed. Number one, prior to the election of Donald Trump, the Fed was on record. And we saw that last year, John, with Janet Yellen in her FOMC press conferences and also on Capitol Hill talking about the need for fiscal stimulus. After the election of Trump, you know, now we have Fed governors coming out. There's been two articles. The Fed's Brainard warns on fiscal stimulus. So we've had like five or six Fed governors, including Yellen, saying, well, guess we don't need stimulus anymore. And so the Journal, it was saying this is sounding more and more political. Secondly, the Fed is moving more aggressive with rate hikes over the next 2 years. We saw that in the December FOMC meeting when they upped their dot plot from two rate hikes in 2017 to three. And the third thing that they talked about is for the first time, and this has just happened in the last week, and we're going to get into the weeds on this and its implications here in a second, the Fed is finally talking about shrinking its balance sheet, which ballooned from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion. So right now, if you look at things overall, you have the Federal Reserve out of sync with central banks around the world. The Fed is raising interest rates while the Bank of England lowered interest rates. The ECB is still involved with quantitative easing. The Bank of Japan is involved with quantitative easing. The Bank of China has been lowering interest rates, which took off some of the fears over, let's say, a hard landing in China. And the result of that has been a climbing dollar, which has been at record interest rates. And we talked about that in hour one with Mark Chandler.
You know, the one remarkable thing going back to the crisis and what followed that, after the crisis, the central banks were pretty much all in sync with lower interest rates or quantitative easing. But now it seems the Fed is the only major central bank going in the opposite direction with rate hikes. And it would seem like there's some real consequences to that.
Well, I mean, there is, and that's one of the reasons why the dollar has maintained its strength. I mean, 10-year treasuries on the day we're doing this broadcast are at 2.5%. If you look at Japan, 10-year Japanese treasuries are at less than 0.1%. In Germany, which is experiencing rising inflation, and the Bundesbank is hinting at that, you know, Mario Draghi needs to cool the quantitative easing, but German interest rates are at 0.486, or let's say up to almost 0.5%. It's hard to believe during the summer they were actually negative. And British gilts are at 1.6%. So the result is, I mean, if you take a look at the U.S. and compare it to Germany, U.S. interest rates are a full 2 percentage points above what you could get in a 10-year treasury note in Germany. So the result is the dollar is at a 14-year high. Now, it was down recently due to Trump's tweet. But what do we have going on right now? We have a rising dollar. We have rising interest rates. We have rising oil prices. And a fourth factor, which could be ominous, is we now have the Fed talking about shrinking its balance sheet for the first time in a decade. Because it took the Fed with QE1, QE2, and QE3 beginning in March of 2009, the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion, which is where it stands today. Now they're talking about shrinking it, and that has implications for rising interest rates.
Hey, Jim, why don't you explain how that works? Because it's easy to understand the interest side, but reducing its balance sheet, how does that interact with rate changes and everything else that's going on?
Well, what it does is it shrinks the monetary base. And one of the unusual things that you have right now is you have a declining monetary base. The monetary base is down 6.3% year over year in a rising stock market. And the Fed, in the last 2 weeks, has now added a new measure. So this is going to be interesting when we take a look at the notes that accompany the next FOMC meeting, which ends on February 1st. If the Fed alludes to shrinking its balance sheet, that's a further tightening. In other words, it's sucking money out of the financial system. And what does that mean? When you take money out of the financial system, the financial markets contract. That's a negative. So you now have Fed officials talking about reducing their balance sheet. What they do right now is if the Fed has a bond, let's say they have a bond that comes due in a year. The bond comes due, they take the proceeds and they reinvest those proceeds and they buy another bond of equal value and equal size. If they stop doing that, then there's less support. They're shrinking the monetary base. And so basically, they could shrink that balance sheet from $4.5 trillion. They could shrink it down to $3 trillion. Just like, for example, in China, China's foreign currency reserves have gone from $4 trillion down to $3 trillion. And so you've seen a shrinkage in foreign reserve holdings of the dollar as countries have had to use their foreign currency reserves to maintain their currency. And just last week, Philly Fed President Patrick Harbor suggests that the Fed could start shrinking its balance sheet as soon as the Fed funds rate gets to 1%. Well, what does that imply? Currently, the Fed funds rate is at 0.75%, having been raised in December. So one more rate hike, which could come in either March or June, would put the Fed funds rate, and what Fed officials are saying, as soon as we get to 1%, in addition to raising interest rates, we are also going to be sucking liquidity out of the system by shrinking our balance sheet. And John, nobody's talking about this. So what is disturbing about this, in addition to raising interest rates, by shrinking their balance sheet, they're going to start withdrawing liquidity, and that has consequences. For number one, if the dollar continues to rise and the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, it's going to create a global shortage of U.S. dollars and dollar liquidity in the international debt market. So the Fed, just like when Greenspan doubled the Fed funds rate in 94, we had a peso crisis, we could have an EM crisis created by the dollar.
You know what? You can see this brewing. It's like a storm moving over the horizon, because this actually has all the indications of a Federal Reserve that is getting very, very aggressive in terms of interest rate hikes, while at the very same time, the Trump administration is moving to stimulate the economy right across the board, get more jobs, get things rolling, cut taxes, get, you know, the burdens on small businesses off. but they're working at cross purposes to each other here. So there's going to be some kind of a confrontation, undoubtedly couched in certain terms that if you don't speak the language may not be understood by the general public, but a confrontation nevertheless.
Well, there's a confrontation definitely coming. But right now, John, I think that's a second half story. Just as if we take a look at last year in 2016, there was a first half story, which wasn't that great, and a second half story, which was much better on economic growth, corporate earnings, and the stock market. But right now, the temporary drawdown in the monetary base is more of a technical factor. A lot of investors, including many of you listening to this program, may be in regular money market funds. There were some technical rules put in place by the SEC. The number one, the money market fund doesn't have to guarantee you a dollar. If you put a dollar in, you could get less than a dollar. So they've gone to floating rates. Number two, money market funds have added liquidity fees, and also they could suspend redemptions. In other words, in a bond market crisis or liquidity crisis, you want to get your money out of a money market fund. Think back to 2008 when the Fed had to backstop money market funds because they were losing money and they didn't have the liquidity. Basically, a lot of, because of those change in the money market laws, you've seen a lot of money shift from regular money market funds to government money market funds. In other words, money market funds that invest strictly in T-bills, because government money market funds are exempt, of course, from the Fed's and the SEC rules. So part of this is technical. A lot of this drawdown has been basically money shifting out of regular money market funds into government money market funds. The good news right now is there is about $2 trillion of reserves in the banking system. So this is not a crisis at this time. That does not mean, however, if the Fed starts to raise interest rates and starts to shrink its balance sheet, that it becomes a problem as we head into the second part of the year. So just as when we were talking about economic growth in a lot of the forecasts that were done for 2017, I think whatever Trump is doing and gets passed is more of a 2018 story than it is a 2017 story. But John, it's going to take the right policy mix. It can't stoke inflation. It can't cause the deficits to skyrocket, because then it's not going to be the Fed that Trump needs to worry about. It's going to be the bond market that he needs to worry about, just as we saw that jump in bond market yields on the Treasury side after the election. So right now, a lot of what is happening is going to depend on the right policy mix, both at the fiscal level with the Trump administration and Congress, and at the Fed in terms of how it handles this balancing act. And that is one reason why, you know, some people are predicting some various changes that could take place with the rise of inflation, maybe higher economic growth and higher interest rates.
And on that note, let's listen to another clip from another Barron's Roundtable member, Jeffrey Grunlock. And as I roll this clip, I should also point out that he was the only member of the roundtable that actually saw a Trump victory.
My guest predicted that a guy named Donald Trump would not only win the primary, but win the presidency. I thought he was crazy. Turned out he wasn't, so we're going to ask for some more predictions today. I'm Jack Otter, editor of Barron's.com. I'm here with Jeffrey Grunlock, the founder of Double Line Asset Management. So let's talk first about your big picture view of the markets in 2017. What are the major forces that you see acting on the markets?
Fiscal stimulus is probably the order of the day, not just in the United States, but importantly in the United States. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops, because fiscal stimulus can add to GDP if it's done in a value-added kind of way. It can also kind of just go into a rat hole like it did back in 08, 09.
And build the deficit.
And build the deficit and create no real movement in jobs or the economy. My guess is that with infrastructure build-out, which I think Trump will kind of trade, I think he's going to give the Republican Party tax cuts that they've been looking for a long time, and in exchange for some a little bit of room on deficit expansion through infrastructure building. That should help GDP a little bit.
Yeah, you can see this working against each other here, this confrontation you're talking about. What Grunlock is saying here is that this could all help GDP, but it does have a lot to do with the Fed and how aggressive it gets with interest rates. And everyone's sort of hoping that the stimulus is going to counteract that.
Yeah, and I would venture to say, John, if, let's say, the Republicans get their stimulus package on spending on infrastructure, which the Democrats appear they want to go along if they get their tax cuts, all that's going to be positive for the economy. Now, if that happens and all of a sudden the Fed starts getting aggressive, starts shrinking their balance sheet, look for a clash between the president and tweets coming from the president against the Fed. Because as the Wall Street Journal article is pointed out in the article last week is, why didn't you raise interest rates in 2012, in 2014, in 2016 when you really had a chance? And now you're raising it now at the end of a business cycle. People are scratching their head. And this is one of the reasons why the Fed has been accused recently of being a very political animal. And the most obvious example is all last year, they were screaming for fiscal stimulus to help the economy. As we pointed out in this next clip, which was taken from last year when Yellen was talking about fiscal stimulus would definitely help. And all of a sudden now, after the election, he says, nope, we don't need it. It's not necessary. We're going to raise rates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Harriet Torrey with The Wall Street Journal. Why does the Fed now see three rate increases next year instead of two? Is it because the economy is at risk of overheating, or is the Fed behind the curve, or is this a reaction to Donald Trump's election?
Well, I would like to emphasize that this is a very modest adjustment in the path of the federal funds rate, and involves changes by only, you know, some of the participants. So in thinking about the paths and the revisions, there are a number of factors that were taken into account by participants. The unemployment rate is perhaps a touch, as I said, a touch lower than previously. You've seen some modest downward revisions in that projection. For this year, there was a slight upward revision to inflation. And some of the participants, but not all of the participants, did incorporate some assumption of a change in fiscal policy into their projections. And that may have been a factor that was one of several that occasioned these shifts. But I want to emphasize that the shifts that you see here are really very tiny.
Okay, well, now, as we bring this thing down to a conclusion here, if we're predicating a clash between the president and the Fed, what kind of an outcome would you think this would have? Because the president can't dictate to the Fed chair what she should do. Theoretically, she could be replaced in 2018. But other than that, what could the outcome be?
When you take a look at 2017, I think it's going to be a first half and second half story like 2016. The best part could be the first half of 2017. You've got this euphoria now. You got money moving into the market. And so far, the Fed hasn't shrunk its balance sheet and it hasn't raised interest rates. And the market has absorbed the quarter point hike that came in December. So I think a lot of it, John, is the better part of the year could be the first half of the year and the second half of the year. If the Fed raises in March or starts raising in June, goes again in September and goes again in October, then I think we could start running into trouble. And especially if the Fed follows through, in addition to raising interest rates, they also start to contract their balance sheet, then what you're going to have is a problem with a rising dollar, a liquidity crisis in the dollar internationally, and shrinking liquidity in the market, which is never good for the stock market. So we're going to have to wait and see. But I think this is, once again, is going to be a first half and a second half story. And watch for more criticism coming to the Fed if the business cycle is aging. And all of a sudden, we're trying to stimulate, and the Fed gets real aggressive with interest rates. Look for the president to call out the Fed and say, what are you trying to do to the economy? And look for some shifting of blame and attention being spotlighted on the Fed. And this is a president that would not be shy of doing that.
And coming up next here on The Big Picture, an interview with Charles Gav of GavCal Research. His concerns, if interest rates rise another 0.5%, we could see a major crisis on the horizon. All that coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
There's a new president in town, and the one thing you can expect is to expect the unexpected. What is an investor to do in such an uncertain environment? Do Trump tweets have you in a twither-dither? Well, investors never need fear uncertainty in the markets with the new Trump Twitter Transaction Tabulator. Yes, from the makers of the Yellen Yap app and the Bernanke Babble Dictionary, a new tool for the troubled trader, the Trump Twitter Transaction Tabulator. Wondering whether you should or shouldn't invest in a particular stock? It's easy. All you need to do is input the latest Trump presidential tweet, and voila! It tells you what to do.
We've issued executive orders to build the Keystone and Dakota pipelines.
Buy, buy, buy pipeline contractors.
We've reinstated the Mexico City policy.
Sell, sell, sell Mexican imports.
What's going on in Chicago?
I hear real estate in Maui is excellent this time of year.
Remember, the Trump Twitter Transaction Tabulator is a must-have for every prepared, prudent prognosticator. Get yours today.
Over the last several years, economists have been puzzled by the lack of productivity, its decline, and low economic growth despite massive stimulus by government. What's the reason? What are the answers? Is more stimulus needed? That's the subject of our topic today, and joining me on the program is Charles Gav of GavCal Research. He's authored a new book called Stagnation or Bust, a Wexilian view of the natural interest rate, the market rate, and asset allocation. Charles, for our readers who may not be familiar with him, who was Newt Wexel, and can you explain who he was and the significance of, let's say, your study?
Newt Wexel was a very interesting guy. He was in Sweden at the end of the 19th century and up to the 1920s. And he wrote extensively, he had extensive contacts with the Austrians. To a large extent, Keynes also was influenced by Wexel. So was Schumpeter. The drawback of the poor fellow is that he wrote either in Swedish or in German. And so, needless to say, he hasn't been really popular because it's not the most not the language that most economists use, Swedish or German. But in my opinion, he's the guy that has best understood the relationship between interest rates and the economic cycle. And so his book is, all his work is basically saying that if you maintain a false level of interest rates, you always arrive at a cycle that becomes self-destructive. So he's a very, very interesting guy for a very simple reason, is because he has been a lonely voice explaining that central banks should not tamper with interest rates except in very, very, very exceptional circumstances. But we probably will discuss that more during the interview.
Yeah, as a result, you said he has two very important and very beautifully simple insights. Can you tell our listeners what those two insights were? And also, as we go further into your book, how you have used those insights to develop your own asset allocation models?
Yeah, the two insights are very simple. The first one is that in an economy at any given point in time, you have not one interest rate, but two. What he called the natural rate, which for all intents and purposes, let's say, is the gross rate of the economy, and what he called the market rate, which is basically the market rate, so you have the natural rate on this. And the difference between these two rates creates a cycle. Let me explain. If the interest rates are too low, it leads people to borrow. If people borrow, usually, they will borrow to buy existing assets that have a higher return than the cost of borrowing. You see, if you can borrow at 2%, you don't need to be a genius to borrow at 2% to buy, let's say, an office building yielding 4%. So it leads to a rise in the price of existing assets because everybody borrows to buy that asset.
And then the market rate, that was one concept, but he also had something or an insight that explains cyclical movements.
Exactly. So what happens then, you see, the price of existing asset goes up, but in fact, the quality of asset doesn't, because nobody build a new building to a large extent, because you can buy the older building, which is already rented. So the price of existing assets go up, but the quality of asset doesn't, which means that productivity goes down, because what causes productivity is the creation of new assets, not the rise in price of old assets. So productivity goes down, and productivity going down leads the economy down. And when there's a guy that have borrowed at 2% with the idea that the assets were going to continue to yield 4, they discover that the assets that they have bought don't yield 4 anymore, but yield 1.5. And then they can't service or repay the existing debt, and the economy collapses. So what creates a cycle is the fact that interest rates are put sufficiently low to lead to a rise in the prices of assets that shouldn't be rising because they don't have the required return. So to a certain extent, the very big insight of Wigzell is that if you maintain interest rates too low, it leads to a decline in the growth rate of the economy, which in itself, when the economy has declined enough, will lead to a financial crisis when all the debt accumulated will not be repayable. Does that make sense?
It does, and I want to come back to that as we work our way through this. His downsides or his insights into cyclical movements induced by these abnormal interest rates, you equate are very similar to the Fishering down cycle, Irving Fisher in his book, Debt Deflation Theory of the Great Depression. So it was a function not only of the Wexilian rate, it distorted the cycle, but how wide the distortion can become. And I wonder if you might comment something that I found fascinating, is this is cumulative. In other words, in each economic cycle, if you keep doing the same thing, its effects are cumulative.
Which means that as long as you maintain interest rates too low, the system moves further and further away from equilibrium, and one day it will return to equilibrium. And the longer you wait, the bigger the financial crisis. So if you could keep maintaining low rates by saying, if I raise my rates now, you will have a big problem, because suddenly you will have the guys that can't repay the debt and the crisis will be on you. But if you wait, the crisis will be more severe later. So it's a catch-22. If the central bank has been following the wrong policy, they have the choice between taking the beating now or taking a bigger beating later.
So as we look at this, you talk about his insights about two rates in the economy. We have a market rate and we have a natural rate. From a practical point of view, Charles, how does one, let's say you're a portfolio manager, how do you follow these? Or how do you determine, for example, what is really the market rate and what is really the natural rate of interest?
So that's a very important question. We're doing a lot of work at Gascal on that. I have the two young colleagues in Hong Kong that are doing some work. It's a little more refined. That's what I've done so far. I've been, as I said in my book, I've been cutting a few corners to arrive at some practical results. Because needless to say, the economists have been discussing about this natural rate and market rate forever. How do we measure them and so on. So conceptually, it looks very attractive, but the question that most people have had over time is, how on earth do we measure these two rates? So the shortcut that I've taken are the following one. When Wigzell talks about the market rate, he talks about a rate that industrial companies would borrow money at for long-term money. And in the U.S., you have Moody's that publishes every day for the last 15 years and every month since the 1920s, the rate at which companies that have issued bonds, long-dated corporate bonds, industrial season, BAA, Moody's, and that gives me a rate which is the cost of capital for these companies, the cost of which is mine market rate. Now, the problem is that the U.S. has had inflation over the last 30 or 40 years, 100 years, and deflation. So in order to, I have to transform this nominal rate into a real rate. So I take the average inflation, 7 years, and that gives me my real rate, and that's my market rate. So basically, my market rate is a cost at which companies borrow money long-term, real, okay, deflated by 7 years inflation. Once I've done that, I have to find the natural rate. And the natural rate, according to Schumpeter, at least when he talked about Wigzell, he said this is a marginal return on invested capital. And through some quick explanation, I've come to the conclusion that over the long term, corporate profits grow at the same rate as GDP. Then I can take for the marginal growth rate of the return on invested capital, which is a shortcut, the growth rate of the GDP. So the, if the cost of capital is too high, it pays to repay the economic center into a debt deflation. If the cost is too low, you have roughly what I've described, which is the accumulation of debt ending in a bad period of no growth. And so it's only if you maintain the market rate very close to the natural rate that you prevent the unhealthy accumulation of debt. So basically what Wigzell says is that the cost of capital should always be very close to the marginal rate of return on capital to prevent the bad guys from borrowing money, or to put it simply, to prevent financial engineering. In a world where Wigzell is dominant, you would have no KKR, because the only way they make money is by borrowing and leveraging to buy existing assets. So that's basically the core of the theory.
So at any time in the economy, there is a difference between the natural rate and the market rate. There are times when they're in equilibrium, which many say that was the great moderation period. But most of the time, they are out of sync. Explain what happens and what's the consequences when these two rates diverge, and if they diverge greatly.
Well, if the rates are too low, it leads to, let's put it briefly, as inflation. If the money is too low, you have inflation. And inflation can be either in the consumer price index, as we had in the 60s, 70s mostly, or in financial assets, for reasons that I try to explain also. So if the rates are too low, misallocation of capital, either the price of existing asset goes up too much, or consumer goods go up too much. If the rates are too high, then it pays to repay the debt. And for example, if you do that for the U.S., you discover that the great problem in the 30s is that real rates on corporate bonds remain all the time, despite what's happening in Washington, Roosevelt, the New Deal, at 6 or 7% real. So during most of the Depression, the cost of capital for the private sector remained at levels that were obnoxiously high. So it meant that companies had to repay their debts rather than build new equipment or hire new people. And you could not recover. The reason why you had the Depression is that the cost of capital for companies remained too high because people were so frightened or what have you. On the other hand, if the cost of capital is too low, you have inflation. So basically, you have roughly a 200 basis point range around, let's say, the growth rate of the economy. If the cost of capital remains in that range, then you have the great moderation and period of steady growth, without any inflation, without any problem, and usually productivity picks up strongly during this moment. So what Wigzell is saying is that the idea of Keynes of proceeding to what he called the euthanasia of the rentier, you know, maintaining very low rates to force people to consume, is going to lead at the same time to lower growth and financial crisis. And this is a policy that has been followed by our central banks since at least 1998 or 2000. So to a certain extent, what I'm trying to say through Wigzell is that the low growth that we have today is a function of what the central banks have done, not of some malediction or stagnation, long-term stagnation or whatever you, as the Summers would have you to believe.
So as we look at current economic cycles, from stagnation or bust is the title of your book, how do we use the Wigzellian spread to map out the economic cycle? In other words, determine whether we're heading for a boom, whether we're heading for a recession, whether it's going to be inflationary or deflationary. How do we use these spreads to determine where the economy's heading?
Okay, it's pretty simple. Right now, despite the very low short rate that the central banks have maintained, which is a zero interest rate or what have you, the ZIRP, strangely enough, the cost of capital, the BAA, has remained fairly high. For example, the real BAA rate is today higher than it was when Mr. Bernanke introduced the ZIRP, which is to show that what Mr. Bernanke did, to a certain extent, he made the fortune of Goldman Sachs or KKR, but it did not have any impact on the real cost of capital of companies, which remained high. So he has led the world into some kind of a financial boom, which is not supported by any rise in economic activity or the value of assets. So it leads to a very dangerous situation if the economy keeps falling. So the big insight of a big sell is to say, fellows, if you maintain interest rates too low, the economy will keep decelerating all the time. You may have one quarter better and so on, but structurally, the five-year growth rate of the economy will keep going down. And this is what we are going to see. So, and if the cost of capital remains high enough, it will be deflationary. So what we have in front of us, if this analysis is correct, is some kind of a deflationary bust. Not an inflationary bust, not an inflationary recovery, not a deflationary boom. What we have in front of us, if the central banks continue with a stupid policy, is a deflationary bust. And in a deflationary bust, making money is pretty difficult. Usually you make money on government bonds. That's about the only place where you make money. This is a policy. This is a big advisor of the Japanese central bank during the 90s and beginning of 2000. Was nobody else than Mr. Bernanke. So look at what happened to Japan with the Japanese central bank following the Bernanke's recommendation. And that's what you're going to have for the U.S. The U.S. is basically following Japan with a 10-year lag. So expect the long rate in the U.S. to go at 0.5%.
You know, as you take this Wechselian view and the natural spread or the spread between these two, the natural rate and the market rate, you at GavCal have come up with or developed something called the four quadrant framework, looking at how to invest. It's an axis where you have prices on one end and you have economic activity on the other. On the top side, you have an inflationary bust or an inflationary boom.
And these two are completely excluded.
Yeah. And on the bottom side, you have a disinflationary bust and a disinflationary boom. So given the four quadrants, how do you use the Wechselian spread to determine in which quadrant you should be invested in terms of where the economy is?
That's where we have made some progress, because I've had that four quadrant published at least since 1978. And with the help of some of these young guys around me here, we have found a way of measuring where we are. And right now, using this spread as a quantitative tool to tell me where I am in reality. Usually what happened in the past is I knew where I had been in the past. You see what I mean? I could tell you, for example, the UK was an inflationary bust in 1977. Okay, but it was after the fact. It was interesting historically, but it wasn't very useful to manage money. So now I have found some kind of tool which allow me to say where we are. Where we are today in the U.S., we're exactly at the border between deflationary boom and deflationary bust. So if we have another rise of, let's say, 50 basis points on the BAA bond rate, then I think we move from deflationary boom, where we have been to a certain extent, the stock market going, to a deflationary bust. And this movement can be externally violent when it happens. You see, there is absolutely no proof that even when it happens, it might be something like 1987, when you wake up on a Monday morning and the market is down 23 or 27%. So the idea is that on a world like the one that central banks have organized, the markets will remain open and liquid is a very heroic idea. If we are on the verge of moving to a deflationary bust, the most dangerous thing for any investor is to have leverage. So I'm pleading for people to have companies that have positive cash flows, don't need banks, don't need to borrow, and are not selling to the governments, if you see what I mean, because the governments might be in dire trouble too. So it's a little bit of a cataclysmic view, but I haven't been responsible for the policies followed for the last 20 years by the central bank. It seems to me that, unfortunately. So what I've done with my clients for the last two, three, 4 years, I've been telling them, look, When we get close to the dangerous zone, you buy some long-dated government bonds because they will go up if we have a crash. But you have really to go long. I'm talking about 20-year duration. And that will hedge your equities. So a 50-50 portfolio, 50 long bonds, 50 U.S. shares, has done extremely well for the last 5 or 6 years. And the only time where I have adjusted that portfolio is when bonds were way overvalued, like in June of last year. Right now, the bonds are becoming buyable again. The 30 years above 3% is buyable. So what I'm saying is, if you want to manage money, since we're on the border between a very bad cycle and a good cycle, maybe hedging with long-dated government bonds makes sense. We are right on the border between the two. And as I'm telling you, it's basically, if the BAA rates go up by another 50 basis points, according to the Vixelian spread, we'll move into the nasty scenario. So we are not that far away.
You know, in your asset allocation quadrant, you use basically four types of assets. And just, I'd like to get your views in terms of why. You have the S&P 500 as a proxy for stocks, U.S. government long bonds, you have silver and cash. Let me ask you, why silver versus gold? Was it because gold was fixed at one time? I mean, why a preference for silver over gold?
It's just because if you have to go back in history, gold was fixed up to 1968 or 71, depending on when you start your... So if you want to do some back testing on the very old cycles, at least silver, which has a component of a precious metal, was always had a market price. Like gold, it was a fixed price. Gold and cash when was the devaluation of gold by Roosevelt? 1934. From 1934 to 1968, gold was cash. I mean, it didn't move. So basically, I used silver because I didn't have the market price of gold for 30 or 40 years. But it works as well with gold if you do your asset allocation since 71 when it became free.
You know, it's interesting, as you tested these asset allocation mixes over various cycles, the one that stood out that worked in both inflationary and deflationary times was stocks. Can you speak to that for a moment?
It's always number two.
And so it would seem like stocks should always be incorporated in either scenario, because whether it's number one in one scenario or it's number two, or it's close to being number two, it always works well in both scenarios.
Exactly. But put it another way, if you accept the volatility of stocks, then you can have stocks for the long term, no problem. We all know that. But the problem is that stocks, once in a while, they take a 50% or 60% beating in the market. And you need a hedge to hedge against that. And if you're in an inflationary period, the hedge has to be silver or gold. If you're in a deflationary period, the hedge has to be government bonds. So what I'm saying is that you should always be in stock and you should always have a hedge. So what matters in your portfolio long term is a hedge, maybe not stocks, if you see what I mean. Because if you choose correctly your hedge, the volatility of your portfolio will be very much reduced without reducing the long term return.
You know, bonds have always worked as a hedge, because if you go into a recession, interest rates eventually come down, bonds do well, stocks go down. But recently, Charles, we saw, for example, last summer, when interest rates got down to almost 1.3% on the 10-year bond, that bonds may be more risky in this low interest rate environment. And you've been talking recently about substituting cash. Why is that?
Then you have to do the second step if you want to do some portfolio construction. You look basically at the fundamentals, let's say you like bonds, but you have to do one step further, which is you look at the valuation. And we have done a lot of work on valuation of the bonds in the U.S. And basically, starting in June, July of last year, up to very recently, the long bonds in the U.S., because of these deflationary fears in the system, were way overvalued. So the reason why bonds stopped working as a hedge, it's not because the fundamentals had changed. It's because they were way overvalued, if you see what I mean. Now that its overvaluation has been at least partly corrected, if not totally, I think they have regained their capacity to hedge if something should turn badly. So it's not a question of the validity of the hedge or that we should move to silver or gold. It's a question of bonds were way overvalued, so they didn't offer any protection anymore.
I want to talk about where we are now, because in your book, you talk about since 2007, you've seen a worrying new pattern has emerged with structural growth rates of the economy falling below its historical range and languishing at an abnormally low 1 to 1.8%. I think as we clock 2016, I think economic growth was well below 2%. And I think you talk about this cumulative divergence between the market rate and the natural rate. However, as you look at this Wixelian spread, and we saw this last year, and in fact, we've seen it a couple times in this economic cycle. If you looked at the first half of last year, if you looked at the economic metrics, if you're looking at industrial production, if you're looking at decline in inventories, corporate profits, everything spelled recession. But then in the third quarter, things picked up. So it was looking like a recession. And then it was like somebody flipped a switch and things changed. Explain that and the consequences of that.
It's a big discussion that we have internally, though. You have put your finger on something on which we have big discussions internally. And the discussion goes like that. To a certain extent, as you rightly said, we have had what you can call an industrial recession in the last 12 months in the U.S. and most all over the world. The OECD industrial production is down, U.S. industrial production was down, corporate profits were down. I mean, we have had the kind of industrial recession. Industrial sales were down year on year, which have never happened before outside of a recession in the U.S. So it was a little bit surprising. But the U.S. economy is moving to a new pattern of development with what we call the knowledge-based economies and so on. And it's becoming so big versus the industrial that maybe we are entering into a new form where, let's say, Apple and Amazon have prevented a recession by growing strongly. So I'm a little bit hesitant here, but we might be at a time where this time is different. The U.S. economy might be moving from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy. And this time, the industrial recession didn't lead to a global recession, just led to a slowdown. That's something that, of course, could happen. And this is why you should not stay out of shares. Because, you see, capitalism is all about creative destruction. And what I'm saying is that we might be close to a period of destruction. Fine. But there is also a lot of creation going on in the U.S., and I don't want to look too bearish. That's why I'm saying in no cases should you stay away completely from equities. Because equities is where the growth in the system will benefit you if you own equities. If you own bonds, you will not benefit from growth. So to a certain extent, what I'm saying is you should play capitalism through the equity markets, and you should play the mismanagement of the equity of the economies by the central banks through the bond market to protect against the bad management. But you shouldn't stay away from the equities. That's too dangerous.
So in conclusion, you talk about we are very close to that lower quadrant of a deflationary bust. I think you said if there was another, let's say, half a point or increase in the Wixelian spread, that would be enough to push the economy over the edge into that left quadrant.
Exactly. We were there, by the way. We were there in January, February of last year. And so it was starting to ring a lot of alarms. And then suddenly interest rates declined, the spreads declined, and everything returned into a working order. So if you look at my work, you see very well that I was advising through the quantitative analysis to move massively in bonds in January or February last year, in October, November, December, January. And then suddenly the dollar peaked, interest rates peaked, and then everything went in reverse. And then the system put us back into equities around May, June. So what I'm saying is that we already had an alert a year ago or so. Right now, we are 50 basis points away from a nasty period, that's all.
Well, Charles, this brings up an interesting question, because in the rate hike that came in December with the FOMC, the dot plot, they raised it anticipating 3 rate hikes, which would be 75 basis points. Could it be very well that the Fed throws us into this very scenario you're speaking of, and that's question number one. And number two, are they aware of the dangers of what they're doing?
First question, I don't know if you remember, was it in 1937 that the Fed raised rates and inadvertently created a secondary depression in the U.S., with the economy falling out of bed and the stock market going down 40% in 6 months? So the fact that the Fed is prone to mistakes, I don't think is any big news. You know, I used to know very well Milton Friedman. He gave me an introduction for a book that I published in France and so on, called Lions Led by Donkeys. And Milton always said that the Fed should be replaced by a computer, increasing money supply by 3% a year. We don't need these guys that always buy at the top and sell at the bottom, if you see what I mean. So yes, the probability of the Fed making a mistake is certainly not zero. What I hope is that the markets can take a rise of, let's say, to 1.5 or 2% short rates, which is where they should be, with the yield curve absolutely flattening. So to a certain extent, the fact that the Fed is raising short rates is bad news for Goldman and KKR, but is not perhaps bad news for the cost of long-term capital for good companies, BAA. See what I mean? And we would have a big flattening of the yield curve. But if we have a big flattening of the yield curve, then the guys that are buying banks like crazy all over the world in the financial markets are going to be creamed, because they're all buying the banks on the expectation that the yield curve will steepen. You can't have it both ways. So either I am wrong, or the guys that are buying the banks are wrong.
Well, it's interesting because, as you point out in your book, every recession in the last 50 or 60 years occurred when the market rate exceeded the natural rate by more than 170 basis points. And most recessions are brought upon by the Federal Reserve. So it'll be interesting to see if we move into that lower quadrant on the left side of your equation of a deflationary bust. Charles, as we conclude here, if our listeners would like to get a copy of your new book, Stagnation or Bust, how could they do so?
Well, they can send an email at sales@gaskal.com, and I'm sure we will find a way of getting them the book. I think since I wrote it, I would say it's a short book, for example, to start with. It's 60 pages, so it's not a 400-page book. But I hope if they do, it will lead them to think a little more. So, I mean, I'm just trying to help our clients think by themselves. Don't believe that what the Fed is doing is right, to a certain extent. It's too dangerous. Believing the Fed or believing the financial press is dangerous for your wealth.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Charles, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. Once again, folks, the book is called Stagnation or Bust, A Wexilian View of the Natural Interest Rate, the Market Rate, and Asset Allocation by Charles Gav. And you can write to Gav Kell, that's GAVEKAL.com.
Well, Jim, as we say, this is a year of expecting the unexpected, and already, although we are expecting some things here, we've talked about the clash between Trump and Yellen. We think that's coming on the horizon. It's a question of how fast that forms. Can you see anything else we will be looking forward to here? You must admit, it makes for good financial talk radio.
Well, I would say the big things right now coming up, once again, watching the market to see if we continue this Trump rally as we hit records this week. So we'll be watching that. The technicals look pretty favorable, as our technicians have pointed out. But we're going to be watching, John. Next Friday, the Fed has a meeting. It goes into February 1st. So everybody's going to want to be seeing what comes out of the minutes. In other words, do they hint at shrinking their balance sheet, which would indicate they're getting ready to tighten further than people expect? And that's something the market is not expecting. We're watching that. We're also going to be watching corporate earnings. We're in full gear now with corporate earnings. So we're going to want to see how corporate earnings come out for the fourth quarter. More importantly, what companies are saying about future earnings. And I can't help but imagine if the Republicans cut corporate tax rates to 20%, you're going to see more corporations or CEOs talk about more favorable earnings going forward. Obviously, if you pay less in taxes, that means you make more in profits, which means more earnings per share. Those are the two big events, and who knows what else they're going to be talking about. This is one president who is hitting the ground running with all kinds of things, so we'll have lots to talk about here on the program. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.